This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Today, the Pinta and the Nina, replicas of Columbus's ships, will open for tours in downtown Cape Girardeau. Plus, there are several other activities taking place downtown this weekend. Stacey Dohan Lane is the host of KRCU's All About Cape and is also with Visit Cape. She stopped by to tell KRCU's Dan Woods more about all the upcoming activities.
So, Dan, I hope you're planning on being in Cape Girardeau the last weekend in September, the first weekend in October, because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I understand we're going to have some visiting history, really.
Yes. On Friday, September 29th, the Pinta and the Nina, they're Columbus replica ships. They're going to be docked at Riverfront Park and open for tours Friday, September 29th through Monday, October 2nd from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. each day.
And these are, I read in some of the information you sent out, the historians consider these type of ships like the space shuttle of their time. Explain that. What does that mean?
So they're called caravels, and they're a Portuguese ship that was used by Christopher Columbus and many other early explorers to discover new worlds. So these ships really harken back to those early days of exploration in the late 1400s and in the 1500s. From what I understand, they're very small. You don't expect them to be as small as they are. And apparently they packed a ton of animals and people and supplies in these ships. So these ships are really going to bring to life what those early days of exploration were like on the sea.
And the Nina was completely built by hand?
No power tools. And Archaeology Magazine has referred to it as the most historically correct Columbus replica ever built. I feel like I should emphasize these are just replicas of these ships from the late 1400s.
But they're going to be here in Cape Girardeau, and there's a chance for the public to come down, and I guess there'll be special things for students to come down. This is a real learning opportunity, right?
Absolutely. And if teachers are interested in setting up a group tour for their class or for their students, they can do that. If you go to visitcape.com/historicweekend2017, we've got all the information for how to book those group tours. And for anybody from the general public who wants to go out and see these amazing pieces of history, they're going to be open for tours from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, September 29th through Monday, October 2nd. So it's $8 for adults to tour both ships. It's $7 for seniors over 60, and it's $6 for students ages 5 through 16. And if you've got any kiddos 4 and under, they can tour for free.
And this coincides with some other things happening in Cape Girardeau around this same time, right?
Yes. If you're bored that weekend in Cape Girardeau, I really don't know what to tell you because we've got the Pinta and the Nina in town all weekend. If you go to Riverfront Park on Saturday, September 30th, not only do you have the opportunity to tour the Pinta and the Nina, the Conservation Department's also doing their yearly Day on the River event. So you can do a free boat ride on the mighty Mississippi River. They've got Asian carp tastings, and they'll have all kinds of hands-on activities really highlighting what life on the Mississippi River is like from that natural perspective. So that's all happening on Saturday. Also on Saturday, Cape Girardeau Heritage Day is taking place as well. So the Red House is going to have a beehive oven baking demonstration. The Glen House has a Victorian tea that you can pre-register for at visitcape.com/historicweekend2017. Chris Museum is doing a float your own boat event, and other historic attractions are open as well to participate in Heritage Day.
Stacey Dohan-Lane is with Visit Cape. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
As Stacey mentioned, you can find out more about the activities happening the last weekend of September in downtown Cape Girardeau at visitcape.com/historicweekend2017. We'll also post the link at krcu.org as well.
That was KRCU's Dan Woods speaking with Stacey Dohan-Lane on the upcoming activities happening in downtown Cape Girardeau. Also, due to overwhelming interest in the Pinta and the Nina, the captain of the ships has decided to extend their stay in Cape Girardeau. The sailing museums will now be docked at Riverfront Park in Cape Girardeau through Sunday, October 8th, adding 6 full days of tours. Ships will be open for tours from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., September 29th through October the 8th. For rural hospitals struggling to stay financially viable, obstetric services, which can be costly, are often among the first programs to get cut. More than half of the country's rural counties no longer have a place to give birth, but women in those counties don't stop having children. Side Effects Public Media's Bram Sable-Smith reports on what happens when maternity units go away.
3 years ago, the only maternity ward in Pemiscot County, Missouri, closed down. So when Sarah Scantling went into labor this summer, she had to drive.
I had the option of Blytheville.
About 40 miles south, down in Arkansas.
Dyersburg.
30 miles east in Tennessee.
Kennett.
20 miles west.
Or possibly Poplar Bluff.
70 miles away. She chose the hospital in Dyersburg, putting her 30 miles away from home and away from her family when her daughter Abilene was born.
And I knew something was wrong when she didn't cry. And then they just rushed her away.
Abilene unexpectedly had a hole in her heart. She was taken even farther from home on a medical flight to a hospital in Memphis, 130 miles away.
I didn't get to hold her for 2 days. I got to say goodbye to her, and that's it.
9 months earlier, when Scantling learned she was pregnant, she didn't know that the county hospital had closed its maternity unit. She thought she'd deliver with Erica Sheffer, the family doctor who helped her through her first pregnancy and through postpartum depression. 6 years ago, Dr. Sheffer and her husband, who's an OBGYN, were recruited to the public hospital in this small rural county to modernize its obstetrics unit.
We were making improvements. We were getting new equipment, new nurses, sending the nurses for more training. And probably 2 years into it, things started going south.
The hospital lost over $3 million in 2013. To stay alive, it started to cut some of its more costly programs, and obstetrics was the first to go.
We all felt it was coming.
That's not exactly surprising for researchers like Katie Cozumanel of the University of Minnesota.
There were 179 rural counties that lost in-county hospital obstetric services between 2004 and 2014.
There are many reasons rural delivery units become too costly to keep around. Medicaid, for example, pays hospitals much less for child delivery than private insurance does. And Medicaid pays for over half of all rural births. Plus, birth rates in rural counties are dropping, just like their overall populations.
And as numbers fall, it becomes harder and harder to maintain the staffing and the skills that are needed to be ready for a birth at any time. And the way that those communities respond differs pretty dramatically.
At the Pemiscot County Hospital in Missouri, Dr. Sheffer does still see pregnant women, but only for 32 weeks. Then she refers them out to a different doctor at a different hospital to finish their prenatal care and to deliver, if they can make it.
Sometimes they don't have a way to get to the new doctor and just show up when it's time to deliver, and sometimes that's by ambulance because that's the only way they have to get there.
Hospitals in this area have a name for that, drop-in deliveries.
Hey, Booker. Is her hungry again?
Sarah Scantling was fortunate, first because she had someone who could drive her to appointments, and also because the Tennessee hospital accepted her Missouri Medicaid. She's back in Pemiscot County now, and she takes little Abilene to see Dr. Sheffer, sometimes even just to double check that the baby girl is all right.
There was times where I would come up here and be like, just listen to her heart. And they were like, honey, she's just asleep.
It's relieving, she says, to be back with a doctor who knows her family so well. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects is a reporting collaborative focused on public health. Today we're bringing you more from our community project, Dear Heartland. Sally Moody was just 9 in 1941 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor during World War II. And many young men from her tight-knit community in Perryville were sent over to fight, some of which were her own neighbors, like her next-door neighbor who had 4 sons that all went in at the same time. Sally tells Dear Heartland about the moment one of the brothers, who was a pilot, flew a B-29 bomber over her Perryville home with a special message.
It was a Sunday morning when the Second World War started, when they bombed Pearl Harbor. And, of course, that shook everybody up. And there were things that we had to give tickets. We had to have tickets to buy another pair of shoes. You had tickets to buy meat. You had tickets from the government because everything we wanted for the soldiers. And there were a lot of things that you couldn't get anymore because the soldiers needed it. And nobody griped about it because there were a lot of boys from Perryville that were overseas. And just like the family next door to me, she had 4 children. One was in the Army, one was in the Navy, and one was in the Air Force, and one was a Marine. And they were all in at the same time. So that family, of course, we were very close to and wanted to know, you know, how then. And the one boy was, he was the Marine. He was in some of those really hard battles. And got wounded, but he came back okay, you know, but he got wounded. But it was a very, very hard. They were battling with the Japanese at that time. And the one that was a pilot, he was over at in Illinois in the military airport over there, but he had to fly to Texas down there. And he called his mom and he said, "I'll be coming over Perryville pretty soon. Look for me." Well, he came over so low in that B-29 that every dish in our house rattled. He came in low. Yeah, there were a lot of things happened like that. And when he said he would fly over and wave Tippy's wing, that one just was special.
Mm-hmm. That was Sally Moody from Perryville. And in case you're wondering, all four brothers came home safe. After the break, more from KRCU's Going Public.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit krcu.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Today we're bringing you more from our community project, Dear Heartland, with a story from a woman named Chali. She grew up in Claryville, Missouri, during a time when millions of American soldiers were sent overseas to fight during World War II. And like many American families, hers was affected by it.
My cousins were older than I, and they were in the service. And it was scary because we did have a radio then that we could listen, a battery radio, that we could listen to the news when they talked about the war and the bombing. And we kids were scared to death. We would be outside playing, and from a long distance, we could hear the drone of airplanes. And it was huge, big airplanes that moved very slow. And we were scared to death, and we'd think, is that the enemy coming to bomb us? And we would all run under a tree and hope they couldn't see us under that tree until it went on over us. But they moved very slow. And then I remember the cousins that was in the service, and Mother wrote these funny-looking, well, she wrote a letter, and then it was photographed to be sent to the boys. And I remember when they came back to Mother unclaimed, and they'd say they were missing in action. And Mother would continue writing them, and please get us a message. Your family wants to know, are you all right? We thought my one cousin had been killed in action. And a couple years later, they actually brought a body back and buried it. And then maybe 30 years later, on his mother's birthday, she had a telephone call. And back then, when you had a long-distance call, the operator would say, long-distance calling from, and she couldn't remember. If she was so excited if it was New York or Pennsylvania. And this male voice said, "Happy birthday, Mom." And we've often wondered, did he play hooky? Did he play AWOL? Was he really killed? Who did they bury? And who called? Was it a spiritual thing, or was it really someone? Was it him? Was he on the East Coast? Did he manage to, you know, there was a lot of people that would leave the war because they didn't want to fight. And he knew he couldn't come back home. They'd have got him. But those years were hard. You know.
Our next Dear Heartland comes from Judy Karen Collins in Perryville. Her father, Dr. Oscar Karen, was responsible for delivering about 6,000 babies in Perry County and other surrounding areas. To most people, he was just Doc or Uncle Doc, but to Judy, He was just Dad. She tells Dear Heartland about her dad's legacy in the community.
He was busy. It was, especially during the war years, the other doctors were called in, and he remained, and there were two older doctors to take care of this community. Town was about 5,000, and all the outlying areas, which we kind of referred to as all the suburbs. He worked 24/7. In those days, no appointments were made at the office. If you wanted to see a doctor, you came to the office and you waited your turn. And some people would even come to the house. If someone came to the house, we just automatically got out of the living room. And when television came in, that was a biggie because we had to leave and not finish hearing the end of the story to give the patient privacy. And the phone rang all the time, it seemed. My dad would be called out in the middle of the night, or one night he delivered four different babies, and so he was on the road traveling from one end of outside Perryville to another end, and timing who would deliver first and where he needed to be for the second baby. And so that night he was on the road all night. I often wondered how he ever got his proper rest, but one that always comes to my mind is two men came to town and they wanted Dad to ride with him out in the country to take care of their father. And my dad agreed to that. It was at nighttime, and they drove for so many miles way out in the country. And you know, he wondered. He doesn't know these two men. They were out of towners, and here he's got way out in the woods. He doesn't know really where he is, and they came to a dead end, and then they had to walk for a mile to get to this man's house. And as they kept walking and walking, he wondered, is he really being set up, and is he going to see the end of this night? And sure enough, they finally did get to their dad's house, and he needed attention. He had, if I recall, maggots on him, and in those days, maggots would eat up your soreness, your inflammation. And he took care of their father. And he thought, well, this will be another charity case, and maybe he will be paid by the two sons after they get back to town. But in the meantime, the gentleman that he was treating reached under his bed and he pulled out a wad of money and he paid my dad right there. So our life was rather hectic. He was a real devoted person, and I learned so much from him in his devotion to people, taking care of people. He taught me so much, even though there were times when we really didn't have enough time to spend with him. He dedicated his life to his profession. I'm just so proud, and I love to talk about him and to talk to other people who felt the same way. They loved him dearly. They gave him a Dr. Karen Day. The whole town celebrated years ago. It was back in the about 1962, even before he retired. And the whole town celebrated. They all wore a sign that said, "I'm a Dr. Karen baby." And one time he was having surgery, and when he came to or before he went under, he looked around and he said, "I've delivered every one of you in this room." the doctor, the nurses. There were at least eight people standing around. And in the beginning, he used to take pictures of all these babies that he delivered. And I've given a lot of them back that I have run into over the years because I thought they would enjoy that.
That's our show. To hear the stories from today, visit krcu.org or find us on iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 for KRCU's Going Public.